This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host Paul Wearson. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Susan, and today we have the report from Leanne Harder here from Nevada with the Story County Report. We'll get to that.
But before we hear from Leanne, I'd like to let our listeners know what's coming up in the rest of the show, because it's unusual. Today we'll be featuring stories about people here in central Iowa who have been active in promoting health in African villages, starting with the World Food Prize. So stay tuned.
Well, Leanne, we're ready for your report, so I'm just right at the edge of my chair.
Good morning. Hopefully I won't disappoint then.
Oh, no, you never do.
There's actually a lot of news to share, so I'm going to talk really rapid so I can get through this, because there's nothing I don't want to miss anything. The Crisis Stabilization Transitional Living Center is a new unit that will be opening later this month. The public is invited in open house. It's located at 124 South Hazel here in Ames. That's just directly south of Lincoln Way, if you go west of Hy-Vee on Lincoln Way. It's on Tuesday, October 23rd from 4 to 6 p.m. The new Crisis Stabilization Transitional Living Center is a cooperative program at Mary Greeley Medical Center, Story County, and Central Iowa Community Services Mental Health Region. It will provide care and support services to persons with a diagnosis of mental illness or recurring diagnosis with mental illness and substance abuse, filling a huge need for those in Story County and in the surrounding area. So again, October 23rd. Go out there and look what it's all about. Then road improvement and update time. Over the next couple of weeks, if you go northwest of Ames, Story County Secondary Roads is working on a really kind of interesting road project, but one that's not really most convenient for some individuals up there. They're doing an asphalt overlay on West 190th, so up by the winery up there. That would really, it's likely resulting in some traffic delays. There's a pilot car that guides traffic from George Washington Carver over on West 190th. It will continue through this week and next week likely, just Monday and Tuesday, though, while they put down the lift asphalt overlay, the final part. So it'll be a nice surface to travel on if you're up in that area. And then in really good news, University Avenue paving is now open south by the Iowa State Research Park. And if you haven't gone down there, looked at the improvements of the research park, it's well worth a trip down there. But especially go south on University Avenue. There's still some grading, minor grading and seeding that needs to be done. But as you know, it's been a little bit wet. And so as weather allows, we'll get out there and get done. That will not affect travel, though. October is National Community Planning Month. It is a month-long event sponsored by the American Planning Association. It focuses on the importance of community planning and its impacts. And the Story County Planning and Development Department would like to invite everyone to an open house on Friday, October 26th. It's being held from 2 to 4 p.m. It will be held in the basement of the administration building in Nevada, 900 6th Street. So you go on the elevator, go down to the basement level, turn right, and then turn right again, and you find planning and development down there. It's an opportunity to go meet staff, and they have a wonderful staff. Discuss proposed projects, learn about planning in Story County. I'll have a quiz for you here in a second. Review recently adopted as well some proposed ordinances. Those talk about agritourism, home business, traffic impacts, access, and stormwater management. We've been doing a little bit of a social media campaign to help advertise the event and celebrate National Community Planning Month. Here's a couple trivia questions for you. Did you know that you're sitting with a planner? I am actually a city planner by trade, and so I'm really proud to celebrate this month. Then another did you know, Story County has had a long history of zoning. We were one of the first counties to adopt it in the state of Iowa, September 2nd, 1958. So really, planning and zoning in Story County is not really a new phenomenon. So again, October 26th from 2 to 4, go meet the planning and development staff. Then October is also Domestic Violence Awareness Month. The Story County Attorney's Office honors victims of domestic violence and homicide and seeks to raise awareness to end domestic violence. There will be a ceremony held at the October 30th Board of Supervisors meeting, to identify October as this month. Throughout the month, they're accepting donations for Access, the Assault Care Center. At both county attorney offices, there's one in Ames at the Human Services Center at 126 South Kellogg and at Nevada at 1315 South B Avenue in the Justice Center. They're looking for personal hygiene items, just items that as individuals are placed in the situation they'll need, have to leave without having these. I think I get announced this one more time after today. The Supermarket of Veterans Benefits is really upon us. The 19th annual supermarket, which averages usually 90 to 125 veterans or surviving spouses, is being held on Tuesday, November 13th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. It's a different location this year. It's the Plex, which is at 5501 GW Carver. So, again, northwest of Ames here. So many opportunities for veterans and surviving spouses to learn about benefits that they're rightfully deserved. Again, Veterans Day is coming up, and a number of opportunities for free meals or meals at no cost and other opportunities such as that for veterans on that day. The animal shelter is really, really looking forward to me being able to come here and say we have a date for an open house. I can't say that yet. I can say I'm going to say that a future announcement, but the remodel is really coming along. We bought that building on Lincoln Way east or west in Nevada a couple of years ago for the animal shelter. We're putting a lot of improvements, making a cat room, making it more pleasurable for both the human as well as the animal experience. Towards the end of the year, that construction will hopefully be finalized. But during this time, we still have a pretty high cat census. Last time I heard, there's well over 100 some cats out there. And their Facebook and social media pages show these animals, and they're beautiful animals. But as they're continuing the $10 adoption special for our feline friends. So if you want a cat, go out to the Story County Animal Shelter. And they also have special rates for pooches as well for $25 for our lovely canine friends, too. Then the last thing, the general election is coming upon us really quickly, November 6th. Just some facts and 101s for you to consider. October 27th is the deadline to pre-register to vote. And also that day is the last day to request a mailed absentee ballot and to have one mailed to you. November 5th is the last day to come to the administration building in Nevada and vote in person. And then, obviously, November 6th is Election Day. Polls open at 7 a.m. and they close at 9 p.m. There will be special hours for the Story County Auditor's Office on October 27th and November 3rd. Those are both Saturdays. So you can go over to Nevada during those days and get voting and let your vote count from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. as if it was just a normal work day. And they may be reached at 515-382-7210. If you have any questions about anything I've said or you need some additional information, just anything county related, I may not know the answer immediately, but I can get back to you with it. I'm at lharter@storycountyiowa.gov, and our website is www.storycountyiowa.gov. And a lot is happening.
It's always a lot happening. Thanks to you, Leanne, we know about it. And, you know, tell us about that planning and zoning. It began in 1958, did you say?
1958 was when we first established, so the Board of Supervisors first adopted a zoning ordinance on September 2nd. So actually, I was false in saying that. We initiated a land use study group and the first zoning planning and zoning commission in 1957.
And this was Story County then was at the forefront.
Yep, we were one of the – and I've been saying this for almost over 20 years now that we were one of the first ones. I know we definitely were one of the first ones. I need to find out if we were the first, and we need to own that and celebrate that. But I know a lot of the larger metropolitan and more urban counties in Iowa, all around that time, we established zoning.
And what's the real strength? Like, what was happening before that happened? It seemed like it had always been here. It must have been chaos.
Well, before that, the city still had a right to go ahead and do extraterritorial authority beyond their city limits. Chaotic may have described it. You know, I wasn't around at that point, but I know nationwide, and especially in Iowa in the late 50s, planning started being thought of as a legitimate practice to help protect adjacent properties, address nuisances, the whole gamut of why we have planning and zoning in place. So the state enabling legislation was put on the books in the code of Iowa, and that filtered down then to the local jurisdictions. Cities have had that since, you know, early 1920 or late 1920s, but then it took a few more years to get to the county level.
That's very interesting because I was in high school in the era that you're talking about. So I'm older than planning and zoning? Is that possible?
I
knew I was older than dirt, but not older than planning and zoning.
Some people do call planning and zoning dirt.
Another, and that's your actual educational background, yeah. Development and this sort of thing.
Yeah, I have a master's degree from Iowa State University in community regional planning, and so did practice. And I am a certified planner through the American Institute of Certified Planners, and I'm proud to be such. And I look forward to October every year because it's an opportunity to celebrate, you know, really what I still consider my profession.
Sure.
And my education training and help inform others of it's not the dirty, evil twin sister out there. Zoning is not. It's intended to help individuals, not be hindrance as sometimes it is claimed to be.
Well, it establishes order.
It does.
You know, I love hearing about making order out of chaos. And I should apply that to my house.
I have some legal decisions from the 1920s I can share with you about order and chaos and zoning.
Yeah, right.
I'll send them your way.
Well, you know, every time you come back, I'm fascinated by what's happening in the county and the great variety. It goes from road construction, as you pointed out, and, you know, capital improvements and real tangible things to special events and opportunities for people. So we need to be appreciative of what the county does and what you folks on staff do in terms of planning and all that. And I know that it's going to be hectic over there during the election.
It is. And it's exciting to see, though. I cherish the opportunity to have to walk. I share the floor with where the auditor's office is. So if you come to vote, you can come visit me as well. I'm just down the hall. When the first day of absentee voting opened up, I had to walk through the lines a little bit to get to the restroom, which was wonderful because that's the right that so many have fought for that we have an ability to do in this nation. And I do cherish having to, excuse me.
Yeah.
and it does get a little bit old. But.
Well, it looks like a great turnout for the election coming up. And thank you, Leon Harder, for your update on the county. We always look forward to seeing you.
Thank you.
And we know you have to gallop back to Nevada. You have kids in school and all that sort of thing.
I appreciate coming. Thank you very much.
Well, you're our friend now, long-standing friend.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, what's next up here, Susan?
Well, we have a little music to set the tone for our last two guests who were here and ready to come in.
From you'll never lose it. The rhythm is strong, but conga music will move you along.
You just tuned in. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. This is Susan Franzen, one of your hosts for today, with my co-host, Paul Wearson. We have just heard Leanne Harder with the monthly Story County Report. Monday night, I attended the Borlaug Lecture, a major event in the World Food Prize activities. It was a very unusual event, and I'm very happy that we have Cornelia Flora, Curtis Distinguished Professor of Sociology Emeritus, here to tell us about it.
Well, Paul here, and I'm welcoming Professor Flora. And I have to confess that I've had an association with the World Food Prize. For several years, I was the voice of the World Food Prize at the ceremony down at the Capitol. And that was live television. And it was a great fun thing to know Dr. Borlaug and John Ruan and all the people who were key in that big ceremony. And I understand it's an exact replica of the Nobel Peace Prize that's done in Stockholm. And so it was very exciting. It was live television. I did not dare make a mistake. And I had to come early in the afternoon because all the previous laureates were introduced and you had to get their pronunciations correctly done. So I've been in love with the World Food Prize for a long time. And Professor Flora, tell us about the event that happened here that's associated with that.
Well, this is quite wonderful that they not only have the laureates talk, the current recipients of the World Food Prize, but they have students who are working in the area, whatever the award is, also give posters and present them, and then they have a prize for the best student posters. And we are very lucky at Iowa State University in that we have really good long-term connections with several countries where our undergraduates go, particularly Uganda, and where they can do research working with local people. And so it was very impressive. One of the things I wanted to mention is how our thinking about food and hunger have changed since Dr. Borlaug did his research. When he began working on hunger issues, there was just a feeling there's not enough, and more was what was needed. Some of us still have that belief. And so he worked particularly on maize and wheat, and later on in Erie, the International Rice Research Institute, they worked on rice to be input responsive. What does that mean? The rice needs more water. You need more fertilizers. And when you have so much more of any monoculture, you therefore have more pests, and you need more herbicides, and you need more pesticides. And so you grew a lot more, but there were some very troubling after effects. For example, with rice. Traditionally in the Philippines, and I have worked in the Philippines, people didn't need to get extra vitamin A because they could harvest all the leafy vegetables or leafy weedy things around the rice paddies. And I have eaten all sorts of delicious weeds that in the Philippines. But when you then have to spray a herbicide, those are all gone. So then you do indeed need supplemental vitamin A. So we decided to breed, somebody decided to breed golden rice, but they decided to breed it into Indica rice, which is a long grain, rather than the Japonica rice, which is what most people in Asia actually grow and eat. Now, we love long grain rice in the U.S., but we grow Japonica rice in Japan and Indica rice in the South, and that's our favorite rice. So they did this particular rice, and then it shattered. I had a student working with an international agricultural institute and found that the women didn't like it because when you pounded rice, which is what you do to get the hull off, it just shattered. So the problem was we were linear thinkers saying, just put it in and it'll be fine, not realizing it has to go into existing system. And what I think is important about the World Food Prize is that there is a growing recognition that hunger is not simply a problem of supply. It is a problem of what is offered. And basically, I came away, my one takeaway from a very, very good sets of conversations led by our president of our university, Wendy Winterstein, is that you have to have a systems approach. And ultimately, what we need to do is structural. We have to make the healthy choice the easy choice, the affordable choice, the available choice. And right now in the United States, we have a lot of wonderful healthy choices if you can afford it. And they pointed out that we had an economist and a public health person share this award, and they worked together beautifully. And that one in three people worldwide, including the U.S., suffer from malnutrition. Malnutrition is not just not getting enough calories. Malnutrition means not getting the right nutrients. And malnutrition can be eating way too much of the wrong things. So we have an obesity problem, which is growing in a number of developing as well as developed countries. And he pointed out that in India, 6 of the 10 most the source of most of 6 out of 10 of the diseases that kill people is are diet related. In the United States, it's only 5 in 10. But in other words, hunger is a problem everywhere, or rather, malnutrition. And if we look at nutrition, it's important. The other point they made, and this was harder for me, was that you have to have a lot of people working together to solve these structural issues. It can't be just the extension agent saying, this is what you should feed your kids because it's better for them. Being told what you're supposed to do and then shifting that to behavior doesn't really work very often. So it's sort of, what are the other ways? So he says we need the science. You need the, and public sector can often fund that very well. And public sector can also put things out. But he said you also need civil society. That is, groups that are able to work together to keep that issue in people's minds and to build organizations that can help make the healthy choice the easy choice. And then you need the private sector. We need people thinking about how they process the food. We need to make making healthy food also allow for making money by doing that, that it should not have to be a charity. And that's where government comes in, that my rule is that under capitalism, which is what the world is mostly under, it is the role of the state should be making it profitable to do what is moral. Civil society determines what is moral. Set the standards. It says, you know, we should not have malnourished people in this world that it has so much. And then sometimes we turn it around. We say, if it's profitable, it must be moral. Let's go with that. But it's saying that how does the state work to help make it profitable to do what is best for the most people, not just the stockholders. Now, our Supreme Court says corporations exist only for the stockholders, but I think that many corporations realize there's something else involved. They also said you need private sector because people in marketing can be extraordinarily helpful. They can make healthy choices fun. And I have seen that in Iowa, where we've had this huge local food to school movement and school gardens, and where you can make a school garden part of any curriculum. It can be part of your English classes. It can be part of your math classes. It's certainly part of your science classes. But you make it fun, and you have parties around it. And it's a place where people gather. So part of this is, where does the private sector and marketing come in? And how do we get people to, since so many people, even in developing countries, buy processed food, how can we make sure it's processed food that has good nutrients in it?
Well, you know, up in Roland Story School District, where I come from, the FFA has a large garden, and all that goes to the local food pantry. And the kids are very committed to this project. When you say make it fun, make it interesting, then those are teenagers who are not only doing the work, but, you know, they sign on to the idea of that community garden. And that's what I like, and that's what you're talking about.
Yes, you know? That is ours, and that we want people in need to get good food. We don't want them just to get the bakery items that didn't sell at the supermarket. We want them to get healthy stuff, and therefore we need to help people eat it. I'm working on a project right now with some people from Michigan State, and we really want people to eat healthier. So working on quinoa and legumes, particularly beans. And one of the things, now one part of beans, and this is still important, are canned. So you want to make sure they don't have too much salt and they're the right kind of beans. But if you're serving or buying dry beans, which is what some of us always do, cooking time is huge. And the shorter the cooking time, the better. Now, that's something most plant breeders wouldn't think much about. But when you're in a developing country, and this is interesting because SIOT had a participatory bean breeding program where you talk to the women and they would tell you what they liked or didn't like about the bean variety. Then you would go back to the lab and sort of work back and forth. And cooking time is important, particularly because fuel costs money. It costs money whether you've got an electric stove, whether you have a gas stove, whether you're out gathering wood and dung to make your fire, it still costs. So the shorter the cooking time, the more economical it is. The other thing we're finding is that all over the world, women are working harder and harder. And that means in the U.S., often you'll have two or three jobs, and you won't necessarily know what your hours are. So something that cooks fast is easier than something that isn't. So it's getting to think of not just how do we grow it, which is systems thinking in itself, but what is that food chain? How does it get to people? So with students growing their garden and taking it to the food bank, and hopefully they're getting input from the food bank about what is it that people really like, you're really getting a short value chain and people understanding that what they're doing has real impact on people's lives.
So, you know, this was what was discussed at the event that you were. What sort of participation did we have? Did you have what you thought was a pretty good participation from people?
There was, at the event. It was very full. People. Now this is the push-pull factors. It was very good, and I think the students sitting around me were very engaged. But also there was a little carrot involved besides the wonderful program. They had a little reception ahead of time with refreshments, and teachers required it. And you couldn't sign in for credit until you stayed for the questions and answers, which were very good. And the students had great questions. So it was a very engaging event.
I will certainly second that. It was not really a lecture, because it started off by everybody who came, if they came between 7 and 8 and got some of the reception, the food, they also had about 12 posters, and they were very interesting and very different from each other. And so you right away, you had people. So when they had the student prizes, you think, yeah, I saw that one. And so it was very engaging. But the two laureates who we haven't named, Dr. Lawrence Haddad and Dr. David Nabarro, who were quite unusual. One was a British subject. The other one was from South Africa, but he had lived and worked in London. They both had somewhat British accents.
And they both had Oxford degrees.
Yes.
They did.
But they didn't lecture. It was mostly just a dialogue between them. And, you know, asking the question, well, how would you do this and how would you do that? And that was, I think, that the message that we got at the beginning from...
So just a great interaction. And the students, I'm sure that was thought-provoking for them, and there were some great questions.
Yes.
And I wish I had been there, actually. Mm. Now, are these posters going to be displayed somewhere?
No, I don't think so. Do you know anything about that?
I don't, but I think it's worth asking. I would assume that the university, I would hope, and I will get back to them, would put it up on a web page somewhere, because they were very good in terms of asking. Some of these were undergraduates. They were both graduates and undergraduates. So one of the hardest things is how do you ask a researchable question? But they also were very oriented, at least some of the undergraduates, very oriented toward how do we make these people's lives better, working with them.
Yes.
And not just do it ourselves. So, like, they were redoing a honey production project. And they said, okay, this time we've got to really involve the local students more. It was at a college. So how do we really involve them and not just walk in there as the experts and do it? And so, I mean, it was just it was really very impressive.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I had. It was my big takeaway. They'd been going there. They'd had students going for 6 weeks a year for 5 years. And the hives were a mess. They didn't, you know, they'd get them fixed up and then they'd leave. Well, this time they figured out what the problems were with the students. They made relationships. They spent most of their time building relationships with the students, and they left them with a logbook so they would keep track of how things went between then and the next year when another group came. This was so simple. You'd think they would have figured it out in 5 years, but they figured it out that year.
One of the things that we were talking about prior to this was the expert syndrome that many North Americans have when we go to other places. Well, we have the answers. If you guys would just do this, everything would be fine. Because we in the United States are wonderful linear thinkers. I think this is what we learn in algebra. X plus Y equals Z. And in fact, and this was one of the other really main points, they said, these are systems. And they said, one nation cannot solve it. You have to have nations working together. You have to have regions working together. You have to have, as it pointed out, market, state, and civil society groups working together. This is something that requires understanding all the pieces. And the more you work with systems, the more you understand those hidden parts that can either make or break somebody's health.
That was great. We could go all morning, Cornelia. Cornelia Flora, who is a distinguished professor of sociology.
Yes.
Emeritus. And she's talking about the Borlaug Lecture held recently at Iowa State, participated in many students and other interested parties, an activity associated with the World Food Prize to be awarded at the Capitol in Des Moines. And certainly the big message I get from listening to you and Susan, who attended, is that the answer to a lot of these problems is collaboration and people working together in an informed way to solve complex problems. Thank you very much, Cornelia, for being here today.
Thank you. And I just think we just mentioned that you're leaving now to get ready to go to Tanzania. Is that correct?
Tanzania, yes.
Yes, and our next guest is going to be talking about Tanzania. So thank you. Our next guest is Dave Fox, who's been involved in a related project directing a building of a water purification system in Tanzania as part of a Rotary project.
Well, now, Susan, we have to get in a station break here. It's KHOI Community Radio, KHOI 89.1, Story City, Ames and surrounding area. Hello, Dave Fox. How are you?
I am just fine. Thank you very much.
Well, start off by introducing yourself and your background and your engineering firm. And just tell us who you are and why you're credentialed to do all these wonderful things.
That's a little embarrassing, but we'll try it. Dave Fox, I am an environmental engineer. Been involved in the consulting engineering business for my entire career of some 45 or 50 years, doing water and wastewater facilities for municipalities and industries here in Iowa and around the country. When I retired about 8 or 10 years ago, I was looking for something to occupy my time and found working with Rotary, who have a large foundation that can help fund projects. It could use some of the skills I had developed. And we've been working on relationships with a community in Tanzania that actually was started by a relationship with a couple of people from Bethesda Lutheran Church here in town and who have common relationships with our Rotary Club. And I think that's a common thread that in order to make projects work, as Dr. Flora was talking, that you have to have a relationship with the recipient and you have to do things that fit their culture. You have to fit things that work with how they do things and how they accept things. And having that communication link established previously has been a great help in allowing our projects to become successful.
Now, you're a Rotarian yourself.
Yes.
And so I'm an ex-Kiwanian. And it's very important for people to know that service clubs are having difficulty maintaining membership. And the service club, really, whether it's Kiwanis or the Lions Club or Rotarians, always have some sort of theme. Like the Lions are very heavily involved in blindness and eyeglasses and getting them to people who are needy. In Kiwanis, we were very oriented toward youth projects. And whether you're in Lions or Kiwanis or Rotary, there's always a foundation which every club supports financially. And you're talking about the Rotarian Foundation that can fund some of these international projects.
Yes, the Rotary has a foundation's very large and very well recognized in the foundation area. We've got very high rankings for their effectiveness, and they actually provide matching grants because the local clubs have to come up with some of the money, and Rotary has districts. I've often said Rotary is probably more bureaucratic than the federal government when you try to work with them. But they do have a way to run money up the flagpole and get your local funds magnified by a factor of 3 or 4 by the time you get all the parties involved. So we have just got notification last week that our third major water system grant has been approved, and each one of our two previous grants and this one have each been about $250,000 and have each provided an operable water system for an entire community, ranging in population from 1,500 to maybe 4,000 or 5,000. And those projects have been very meaningful and successful and have led to a lot of economic development and improvement in the facilities there. Just one example, our first project, we a village of 1,500 people that had no potable water available to the community at all. They had to walk 3 or 4 kilometers to find water and haul it back. Used up all the time of the school children and the women to do that, taking their time away from studies and other things they could be doing to help their life. In the process of providing the water source, they have good groundwater available, Actually, the quality is similar to what we have here in Ames, which to do that, it's very deep, required a large electric motor in the well, and so we had to bring electricity to town, which they didn't have that either. In the process of doing that now, after 2.5 years of operation, they have electricity to their school. They never had lights before. A large number of the community houses now have electricity in addition to their water supply. Some of the homes are now running water directly into their homes. That wasn't a standard. Just had distribution points.
What time frame are we talking about?
We are talking, this particular project was completed in 2015.
And so just in this short time, the community has had all these ancillary benefits of, electric power for lights and all this sort of thing, because electricity was brought in to power the water system.
Absolutely. Because of the water, a lot of them have their home gardens, so they're growing. They have a lot of animals that they don't have to herd over large distances in order to get water. They can keep them in the village. Said the last time I was over there last summer, or even a couple of houses in town that had satellite dishes.
And this is a very short time frame.
Absolutely.
So you see all these ancillary benefits from the original idea of bringing the electricity in to power the pump. And I assume that the work to go down and get that water and all the equipment involved, that's where your funding came in.
Yes, the funding covered the construction of the well, provision of the pump, and the building of a house to provide the piping and metering and disinfection. We disinfect with.
Well, how challenging was it to get electricity to that area?
It was. Electricity has become a lot more reliable in the last few years, but initially it was the closest electricity was like 3 kilometers away, so it actually cost that first village $60,000 in order to run electricity in.
And that was their funding. They had to do that.
That was funding that we provided.
Oh, you did that also?
Yeah, we provided that as part of the grant.
This is tremendous because, without electricity, you can't do your project. And if you can't do the project, they don't have the water. How deep was the well drilled?
Actually, the groundwater level is about 400 to 450 feet. And the level of water was such that it was about 300 feet to water. So to get that pumped out of the ground, we had to provide for 30 gallons per minute or so of water, which took a 7.5-horsepower pump. So that you can't do that with solar. So
no.
Although we would have liked to, because it would have been a lot cheaper, but it just doesn't work out.
Well, I bet the folks there really appreciate what's happened. And look at all the little and small and large things that now happen in that community because of this one central project. It has to make you feel good.
That, too. And I like to say that one of the serious reasons why these things work through the Rotary Project is that Rotary has clubs all over the place. And there's a Rotary Club in the main town in that area that we have worked with over these entire set of projects. This club has 15 members only. And because of their efforts, and they are able to keep track of and do all the administration, they hire the contractors, they pay the bills, they keep track of all the grant money, and because this could not be done, as I said, I've managed a lot of projects in my life, but you cannot manage a project from 8,000 miles away.
Well, that's what we got from our talk with Professor Floor. You just have to have someone on scene that's monitoring, making sure things continue to happen after your construction and input and original development occur, because otherwise you'll come back with widely separated visits and find out that something's deteriorated or failed to happen. And so it's key that there's a local Rotary Club to do that work. and keep in touch with you about problems that come up, too, I suppose.
That is the that's the key to making this work, in addition to, you know, interviewing and finding out, as Dr. Flora pointed out, what the local people actually want is important, because if we come in and give them what we think is the best solution, it's in all likelihood it won't be sustainable. But since they participate in identifying their needs, that then we try to help them solve those issues, and the local Rotarians are able to monitor that and help us make sure that that is something that will become sustainable.
As we say goodbye to Dave, I want to let our listeners know there is an excellent film that shows the village you've been talking about, right?
Yes, we have a probably a 17 or 18-minute video on YouTube that was developed by Rod Botholt, our local he's in our Rotary Club. It's also a videographer that explains all of our projects. And it has interviews of two of the local Rotarians in Tanzania that were here this summer, and they helped identify those things. And
now, how do
all
they access
benefit.
That film? Is that
it's going to be on our website.
That'll be on our website.
I'm pretty sure that we can put the link up, and I would highly recommend it. And actually, we have a picture from the village, our identifying picture this week, of happy children in the water.
Well, the main thing here from this whole program today, we're talking about the World Food Prize and Professor Flora, or you, Dave, is the idea that, number one, collaboration is important. Number two, you don't impose solutions on others without finding out what their needs are and what they verbalize that their needs are. Because what we're trying to do here, especially in developing countries, is avoid the colonial model where we come in and impose something without getting any kind of understanding of the culture or the needs. And then it's so important to have people on site, whether they're Rotarians in your case, or just people who are appointed or leaders in the local population who can make sure things continue to happen after all kinds of work is done by an outside organization like Rotary or any organization that goes to developing countries to make sure that infrastructure is built and organizations are formed so that things can happen and continue to happen, because you don't want to leave something there that started out great and then deteriorated, right, Dave?
Absolutely. And yeah, what we like to say is that we're doing development projects that are sustainable and not doing charity.
That's very important. And today, to me, has been very reinforcing and encouraging that people like Dave and Professor Flora and all the organizations that we've talked about associated with the World Food Prize are doing things to enliven and ensure good health and to have viability that wasn't there before in developing countries. Thanks, Dave, and we're so happy with what the Rotarians have done and what you've done. And you've become a world traveler now, haven't you?
I've been there a few times, yes, sir.
That's for sure. That's great. Well, this is KHOI Community Radio, and you just heard from two Ames people about working in villages in Africa. One, Cornelia Flora, represented the work possible through Iowa State University, and our other friend, Dave Fox, worked through the International Rotary Clubs to bring the technical training from his environmental engineering company to a water and wastewater project in a Tanzanian village.
Maggie Westfold, who usually closes out our Wednesday show with points to ponder, isn't with us today, so I'd like to ponder today with music and a story. I've chosen one of the songs from a record my son gave me back in 1984 when he returned from the Peace Corps in Kenya. The record was made by the South African music group Jaluka, which in those days was radical because it was interracial, combining traditional Zulu music with the beat of anthropologist, or I guess archaeologist, Johnny Clegg. My son told of copying it on a cassette in his village without access to electricity. They did have some batteries. When I went on YouTube to check out the record, I found a response after response with similar stories of people who discovered Jaluka in various countries in Africa during the time of apartheid. The song that reached out to me is called Simple Things. I find it haunting, a haunting warning for today. I hope you can hear the words.
Wanderers and nomads have gone to see their chieftains. Will this be the end of the rain and the birds? Who can send an emissary to speak to the seasons? For the ravens and the crows already soak up the skies.
I'm digging for some words beneath the stones in Zimbabwe. I'm searching for a drum song in the jungles of Zaire. I'm groping for the black moon in the mountains of Malawi. Looking for the lion of Ethiopia. Settling dusk is darkened by the bark of the baboon. The frogs and the owls no longer call to the moon. The warlords have gathered, blue smoke hiss from teeth of chrome. And the Baobab trembles in the boiling blood law. The fireplace is broken and the grinding stone too. Its million pieces flung across the plains of Africa. Each dusty fragment, a seed from which grows the memory of a death that only you and I will know.
Wanderers and nomads have come to see their chieftains. Will this be the end of the rain and the birds? Who can send an emissary to speak to the seasons? For the ravens and the crows already soak up the sky. Soldiers have been summoned from Saigon. A craven walkie-talkie puts their bloodshot armor on. Some drink beer, milk, some drink in Kikola. Sheepdogs live in Otaniqua, gun dogs in Angola. Flames lick the corners of each hungry horseman's smile. They have locusts in their scabbards and deserts in their eyes. Passing through the air, they lead a sea of fetid rumors as they ride upon the skyline on a secret trail of lies. Wanderers and nomads have come to see their chieftains. Will this be the end of the rain and the birds? Who can send an emissary to speak to seasons, for the ravens and the crows already soak up the skies.
I've found some words beneath the stones in Zimbabwe. I've heard a distant drum song in the jungles of Zaire. The black moon spoke of war in the mountains of Malawi. But I never found a lion of Ethiopia.
Wanderers and nomads have come to see their chieftains. Will this be the end of the rain and the birds?
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. Paul Wearson and I, Susan Franson, have been your hosts for today. Other voices you heard were Leanne Harter, Cornelia Flora, and Dave Fox.
And you can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Now that's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. KHOIFM.org. There are also rebroadcasts of this morning's show at noon and 7 p.m.
Local Talk was engineered by Aladdin. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Special Music and Simple Things by Johnny Clegg and Sifo Michutnu and the band Jaluka from their album Scatterlings.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878 or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Just look for the yellow Donate button.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and
see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes from Stevens Auditorium, presenting Celtic Thunder X, an Irish male vocal group that will feature new songs and traditional Irish musical instruments, on Wednesday, October 17th at 7:30 p.m. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu.
Deep in the sky.